Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Love the way you love me. Love the way you stare. Know you're thinking of me. Know you always care. Calling me when I'm lonely. Like you know my every move.
Listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio Network, the home of Night Dreams Talk Radio, with Gary Anderson, syndicated worldwide. Paranormal Talk Radio, like you remember. The Mount Blanco Fossil Museum. What a place. It has over 100 fossil trackways, mammoth skeletons, mastodon with living bacteria, 12-toed horse, giant donkey, crocodiles 40 feet long, salamander 12 feet long, wagon trains in limestone, the world's largest bison, blue fossils, black, white, red, purple, brown, yellow, gray, and clear, dinosaur soft tissue, Bigfoot, Mothman, Dogman, Chupacabra, elongated Peruvian skulls, UFOs, giant men, all here at the Mount Blanco Fossil Museum. 124 West Main Street, Crosbyton, Texas, 79322. Open 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. Online at www.mountblanco.com. Call 806-675-7777 or email us at mountblanco1@aol.com. Southeast Oklahoma is the backdrop for a paranormal thriller series by author John Vandeventer. When Sasquatch-like creatures terrorize the town of Tallahena, Oklahoma, a Choctaw elder and his son, assisted by law enforcement and the military, are able to restore peace. 2 years later, the creatures return along with UFO activity and an even darker ally. Enjoy exciting, high-intensity paranormal epics? Then read Relics The Dark Autumn and Relics to the Hanovia Remnant by John Vandeventer. Available now at Amazon or at www.relicsbook.com. That's www.relicsbook.com.
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Night Dreams brings on the night worldwide. Did you know you can find us on your favorite app? And now you can watch us live on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to our channel and give us a thumbs up. And now, here's Gary.
And here I am. And boy, the weather yesterday was 64 degrees down at the compound. Today it's in the 80s. Tomorrow they're saying 85. It's just all over the place. And boy, you know, the other day I was watching some of our trees dropping the leaves like fall. It is a lot of weather changes going on, earth changes going on. Well, Boyd Bushman, on his deathbed confession about Area 51, said he had three little pieces of UFO wreckage. Now, again, Congress here and the CIA and all the DOD and all these organizations said, now, there's no proof any crash ever happened at Roswell. There's never been a reported UFO crash. They have no wreckage, no nothing. And again, everybody was waiting for this major disclosure. And I warned everybody it wasn't going to happen. I hear it every couple of years. Major disclosure is going to happen. Well, you know the government. They're not going to tell us the truth. And maybe we can't handle it. I don't know. Well, a new breakthrough in biology. Scientists now are, well, being able to grow food, plants, in total darkness. Now, do you find that one kind of interesting, James?
That is interesting, because I know they've often talked about, you know, at nighttime with moonlight, but you know what? That opens up a lot more doors to expand the growing seasons anyway.
Well, if we ever have a super volcano go off, okay, and we go into darkness for a period of time, you know, like a nuclear winter type of scenario, well, then maybe we can grow some plants to eat. I don't know. That's kind of interesting. You know, also, they just dug up a Egyptian shrine that had hidden treasures, and they unearthed velocity of the sun.
Oh, I did see something about that. I'll tell you, that's fascinating. The stuff that they're finding now, listen, that's going to open up a whole lot more of information about, well, how they lived and how they done things, because Gary, like you said, there's some kind of lost technology that with all this going on with the pyramids.
I know, again, what were they? Were they for navigation? Some people said they were water pumps. But again, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, they found in the Amazon, the lost cities of in Amazon and a pyramid. And isn't it funny? All around the world, They keep finding pyramids, and they're even speculating there's one in Antarctica. And that was in the news here last week.
Yeah, listen, you're right. You know, supposedly they never communicated with each other, but they're finding pyramids all over. You got them China, Bosnia, even Alaska, maybe there's these pyramids. Central South America?
I know, it's interesting. Well, you know, it's kind of chilling. The Air Force said that they dispatched a fighter to, you know, to investigate this unidentified UAP. And they came back and they said that craft was going approximately 11,500 miles an hour. And it was spotted by literally hundreds of troops.
Wow. That is moving out. Yeah, and here's the thing with those. They just don't move that speed. They, like, turn on a dime. And, like, you know, Dr. McAlee said, humans just can't do that, not with our technology that we know of.
Well, you'd look like Jell-O inside, you know. And even if they were drones, okay, they would, I don't know how they would keep from disintegrating, let alone any type of, if it was off from our world, not off world. I don't know any materials that could handle those speeds without disintegrating. That's really interesting. Well, tonight we're going to be talking with a great guest. We're going to talk about one of the Godfathers about remote viewing. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Val Von Torn of Metatron Power and Light. You're listening to Gary Anderson and Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Stefan Schwartz, scientist, futurist, award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction. Stefan A. Schwartz is a distinguished associated scholar of the California Institute for Human Science and a Beal Foundation Fellow. He is a columnist for the journal Explore and editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, in both of which he covers trends that are affecting the future. For over 40 years, as an experimentalist, he's been studying the nature of consciousness. Schwartz is a part of the small group that founded modern remote viewing research and is the principal researcher studying the use of remote viewing in anthropology and archaeology. In addition to his own nonfiction books and novels, he is the author of more than 250 technical reports, papers, academic book chapters, prefaces, and introductions, and has made over 1,000 presentations to universities, institutions, and government agencies around the world. His work has been covered worldwide by numerous magazines, newspapers, and television productions, and he's the recipient of the Parapsychological Association's Outstanding Contribution Award.
Well, Stefan, I want to welcome to you to Night Dreams Talk Radio. How are you doing tonight?
Very glad to be with you.
Yeah, you're not that far away. You're on Whidbey Island, and, you know, that's just a hop and a jump, you know, if you go by the sound way. But, you know, God, that's a beautiful place. I grew up there.
Oh, well, it's a beautiful place, no question.
Is it getting more popular? You know, when I was there, you know, you could, when you left Langley and if you were going to go to the middle of Whidbey Island or whatever, I mean, there was this areas of trees, you know, there was farms there. I actually, my mom's cousin had a nice farm there for many years. Has it been growing up now? A lot of homes and stuff like that, or is it still?
Well, yes, there's a lot of development, but it's still, the South Island is still very rural. Which I like.
Oh, yeah. That's a beautiful place. I think it's one of the, that and Orcas Island and a couple of places. I just love it. I got to ask you a question. How old were you, Stefan, when you got interested in the paranormal and strangeness of things out there?
Well, I was 23 when I woke up. That's the way I think of it anyway. And began to realize that materialism was not an adequate explanation to what was going on.
Interesting. And what really made you make that, what happened in your life to cause that thought?
Well, I was working in New York. I had just come out of the Army. This is back in 1964. And I had just come out of the Army, and I was working as a screenwriter for a company called Screen Gems. I don't know if it exists anymore, in New York. And I went to a party that Truman Capote gave. I got to know him a little bit. And I went down the hall to go to the bathroom. And there was a guy writing in a book and he had cut his finger in order to get the blood to write with, which was, I thought, very weird. And I came back down the hall and I looked in the mirror and I saw myself in this sort of antique Italian mirror. And for whatever reason, I couldn't explain it to you. I just spontaneously said to myself, you are becoming an unattractive person. Your values are not right. And I left the party and went back to Manhattan and got in my little car. And I drove back to Virginia, which is where I'm from, Tidewater, Virginia. And it's the only time in my life I've ever been depressed. And I was sitting on the porch a few months later, and I saw this couple walking in the gardens of my family's farm. This was a farm that was a land grant that Queen Elizabeth I had given to my great-great-great-great-something grandfather. And I looked at these people, and they looked like they were dressed for Manhattan. He was wearing a double-breasted gray suit, and she had this very stylish linen dress on. And they saw me looking at them, and they came up to me, and I opened the door to let them in the porch. And the first thing she said after looking at me was not, you know, who she was, which is what you'd expect. She said, "Do you believe in reincarnation?" And I had never thought about it, to tell you the truth. I had the good fortune to grow up in a family that had absolutely no religious involvement at all. And I had read about reincarnation, but I didn't really know anything about it. And I looked at her and said, "Well, yeah, I think actually it's kind of symmetrical. So I probably do, but I don't know anything about it." And then I said, "But wait a minute, you know, who are you and why are you here?" And it got weirder than that. She said, they introduced themselves as Ed and Paula Fitzgerald. And she said, I said, "How did you get here? I mean, we lived in a very rural area that you were down a 10-mile unpaved school bus road, and our lane was a mile long. And how'd you get here?" And she said, "Well, I had a dream that told me to come up and invite you down to Virginia Beach." I said, "What? You had a dream? How could you possibly know where the turns were?" And she said, "Well, in the dream, I could see it, and I wrote it down, and we just drove it." And I said, "Well, and why do you want me to come down to Virginia Beach?" And she said, "Do you know who Edgar Cayce is?" And I said, "No." And she explained to me her understanding of who Edgar Cayce was, really quite extraordinary, I would say, probably the best documented remote viewer in history. Just at that point, a car came down the lane driven by this young couple, and she said,
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Give me your telephone number. And I gave her my telephone number, and she got in the car and drove away. And I thought, what the hell just happened? I mean, I just didn't know what to make of that. So about a week later, I get a call, or 2 weeks later, I get a call from a guy who invites me down for the weekend to Virginia Beach, and he gives me an address. And as I said, I was very depressed because I had been successful. I was a screenwriter. You know, I was going out with attractive women. I'd bought a Mercedes convertible. I thought, you know, I was doing all the things and being successful. And yet I realized that there was something wrong or something missing. Anyway, I drove down to Virginia Beach, and I got to the address that I had been given. And there was a young man on a ladder putting up a sign for a shop. And I said, I'm looking for T.J. Davis. And he said, "Well, he's not here, but Joni's here, and she is expecting you." And around the corner came this really quite lovely woman with the most beautiful lavender eyes. And she said, "I'm supposed to take you up to the ARE." And I said, "What's the ARE?" And she explained to me what it was, is the organization that retained the Cayce material. And so I drove up with her to the Cayce campus and got out of the car, and she took me up into the building and into the library. And along one of the walls were these green loose leaf notebooks. And she said, "Those are the readings." And she explained to me her understanding of what a reading was, that Casey would go into a kind of trance state and he would answer questions and could answer questions about anything, could speak in foreign languages. I mean, really very interesting.
Now, I got to ask you a question, too. Didn't he also, people went to him with medical problems and he would tell them what their medical problems were?
Oh, yes. He, in many ways, he is the father of holistic medicine. Yes, and you didn't have to go to him. You just had to send him a letter with a request and give him your address, and he would describe what your problem was and would give you a treatment, and they worked. As I said, he, I mean, in many ways, he's the father of holistic medicine. In any case, I just randomly going down the wall of these green loose-leaf notebooks like you'd have in school, I just pulled one off the shelf and opened it up at random. And it was a reading given in 1936 for a woman. And it said that she had been a teacher of astrology at the Essene community at what I recognize to be Kirbet Qumran in the Middle East. And that she had taught astrology. And it's hard for me to explain to you, Gary. When people tell you your hair can actually stand on end, it can. Because in 1936, there wasn't a single person alive that knew that there was an Essene community at Kirbet Qumran. And no one knew that women were involved with the Essene community and knew nothing about their interest in astrology. It wasn't until 11 years later when a young Bedouin shepherd was chucking rocks into a cave and he heard something go clunk and he went down and found what we now know as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And of course, the scrolls talk about this obsession or fascination with astrology, and the archaeologists who excavated the site, which was at that time thought to be the an outpost of Emperor Vespasian's legions, but turned out to be an Essene community, a kind of monastic community, but there were women involved, not a monastic, a religious community, and they found female skeletons. And so I'm standing there holding this book, and I didn't know what to do with that because I had worked for National Geographic until I got drafted into the Army. And the last thing I had done for National Geographic was to do research on the Dead Sea Scrolls for an article that was going to appear in the National Geographic magazine. And I knew a lot about the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Essene community because I had done all that research. And I just could not figure out how a man could know in 1936 something that wasn't discovered by any other living human until 1947. And I said to her, let me take you to dinner. I've got some questions. Anyway, the result of that was that it completely changed my life. I wanted to know how it was possible that somebody could know that kind of stuff. And I decided after I'd read some more of the readings and got a sense of what they were, that I was going to read them all from the first one to the last one. And I went down to Gladys Davis, his lifelong archivist secretary, and told her what I wanted to do. And I met Hugh Lynn Casey, Edgar Casey's son. And I explained what I wanted to do. And they said, well, okay, we'll help you. And I started reading the Edgar Casey readings. As I said, read all of them eventually. And about halfway through, I thought I need to find out what science knows about this. And I don't think I've even heard the word parapsychology. But in any case, I went to the libraries, the university libraries that were near Virginia Beach. And I asked if they had any magazines or any academic journals that reported this kind of research. And it turned out they did. And so I then started reading all of the parapsychological journals from when they began at the turn of the century, 20th century, up to then. It was about 1967, 60, just turning 68. And in 1968, I decided that I wanted to be an experimenter. And I just walked away from all my previous careers, turned down several jobs and decided that I was going to start doing experiments. And I began by building a grid in my back garden in my house in Virginia Beach. And I made a mimeograph, that's how old we're talking about, of that grid. There were originally 12 squares. It grew to 144 squares. And I would bury mason jars or 35 millimeter film canisters in one of the squares, one of the grids. And then I would send out these blank sheets of paper that had the grid drawn on it. And I would ask people all over the world that I knew if they could locate which of the grids I had buried the object in and describe for me what it was. And I called this distant viewing. It's what today we call remote viewing. Both terms are terrible, by the way. It has nothing to do with remote and has nothing to do with viewing. But in any case, that's just a term. So I started what I call distant viewing. This is 1968. And I had a friend who was a statistician, and he said, well, if you made more squares, you know, it'd be more powerful statistically. So I made it 144 squares. It didn't make any difference. People could still do it. And I, because I came out of an anthropology background, I got interested particularly in archaeology, because at that time, most of the archaeological finds that were made were serendipitous. That is, a farmer who would be plowing in a field would find a tomb, or a road crew that was building a highway would turn up a temple. So most of this stuff was serendipitously found. And I thought, well, this is a perfect situation for triple blind experiments, because I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it to the absolute highest scientific quality you could do. And nothing is better than triple blind. That is, nobody knows the answer at the time that you're seeking the information. So there's no way that you could get it from anybody. You couldn't read their minds. You couldn't read their books. You couldn't find it in a museum, you know. And so I began planning for an archaeological project, and then I decided, well, I'll write a book about all the research that had been done prior to what I did. And that book became Secret Vaults of Time, and it's still in print. You can still get it on Amazon. And it reported the stories of people like Frederick Bligh Bond, who reconstructed Glastonbury Cathedral in England, and who did it using automatic writing, which is a kind of channeling of remote viewing, or a man named Wyatt, and he had found that great Olmec head that you see on the vodka ads. That was found by a remote viewer. Anyway, I did this for the next year. I did this book. Next couple of years. And then I decided that I would get formally involved academically. So I went to the American Anthropological Association and met a guy named Joe Long. And we proposed to the American Anthropological Association that they allow us to hold a seminar at their annual meetings. And in 1973, we did hold that seminar. And we got all the leading people in the world to come and make presentations. And out of that, I was approached by a young archaeologist to see if we could find the talking idol of Ixchel on Cozumel Island in Mexico, and we did. And then I was offered a fellowship in Los Angeles at the Philosophical Research Society. And I went out I got interested in, was this electromagnetic in nature? That is, at that time, in the early 70s, it was generally thought that what we would call psychic, it's a word I never use, by the way, that it was electromagnetic, that it was some kind of radio phenomena. And I had been the special assistant, before I got into that, I had been special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations. And while I was the special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations, I was briefed on a project that the Navy was doing called Project Sanguine, and that was, could they use ELF, 300 to 300 hertz, that's a particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum, to communicate with the deep ocean missile submarines. And also, while I was special assistant, a friend of mine was the head of the CIA, and he began sending me, I don't know how he got them, but he began sending me translations of documents done by a man named Vasiliev in Russia, who was asking the same question. And Vasiliev had put people down into caves and down into mine shafts and put them into Faraday cages. That's a kind of structure that blocks electromagnetic radiation. Anyway, he was a very good researcher, and he did all this research. And he finally said, well, the only way you could really finally answer this question is to put them in a submarine and submerge them, because seawater blocks electromagnetic radiation. But I don't know how deep it is, and I can't get anybody to let me do it. And I knew Hyman Rickover, who was the father of the American nuclear navy. And I went to him and asked him, and he thought about it for a while and said, well, let me get back to you. And he called me up and said, no, I don't want to do that, because it'll bring a lot of attention to the deep ocean submarines, the missile subs, and we don't need that or want that. So I'm sorry. And then when I went to philosophical research, I stayed with a friend of mine who had been deputy director of Navy Labs, a guy named Don Keach. And he said, you know that crazy experiment you wanted to do where to put people down and do this, that weird thing you're interested in? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we've got a submarine that's coming down, and we'll pay for 3 days to let you do this experiment. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. And I began planning for it. And I decided I would do two parts to it. One, I would ask the remote viewers who were scattered all over the world. I just sent them a map, a sea chart, and said, please locate a previously unknown wreck on the seafloor.
Okay, Stephanie, now we need to take about a two-minute break, and then we'll come back to this. And also, after you explain this, can you actually explain what remote viewing is? Now,
of course.
Major Ed Dames, has his view. We've had other people, and it kind of varies a little bit. But, I want to know a little bit more, and if anybody, you would know. We'll be back with Stephan right after this. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio. Don't forget, starting in July, every Friday, the last half an hour, we're going to take call-ins and go to our website, find out more about it, because we're going to be giving out a lot of Roswell, gifts from Roswell, water bottles, UFO this, pins, you name it, hats, mugs, and all that stuff. So stay tuned for that, and we'll be right back. So stay tuned.
Deep in the desert wilderness of Arizona, there lies a fabled treasure trove of gold. One that was said to be enough to make 20 men millionaires all the way back in 1891. Many have searched for it, but all have failed. After years of research, author Matt Polston debunks many myths surrounding the mine, including the location. Your next adventure awaits in The Lost Dutchman Mine Location, Rewriting History. But are you brave enough to take the first step? Available on PolstonHouse.com, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble. Get your copy today. The Lost Dutchman Mine Location. www.PolstonHouse.com. You are listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio Network, the home of Night Dreams Talk Radio, with Gary Anderson, syndicated worldwide. Paranormal Talk Radio, like you remember.
And we are back, and we're talking about remote viewing. And I'll be honest with you, Steph, I can't believe...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. You had those people come up to your house and come to the door. You know what? I will be honest with you. I would have peed myself. You know, well, I don't care how old you are. If somebody would come to the door and all of a sudden, you know, explain they were here, they had a dream, I'd be scared.
Well, I wasn't scared, but I did think it was quite odd. But you know, it happened. I mean, it is what it is. So there it was. Anyway, you wanted me to finish this.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
So the task was, could remote viewers penetrate the seawater down to the seafloor? I knew from the Navy research exactly how deep ELF would penetrate, and the seafloor was hundreds of feet below that. So could they penetrate down to the seafloor and describe a previously unknown wreck? That was the first one. And the second one was, could I put people in the submarine and take them down to depths that ELF was not an explanation and see if they could accurately describe where people were hiding? It's called outbound. That's called the outbound protocol. And I decided to film the whole thing. And you can go actually see this film. You can go to my personal website, stephanaschwartz.com, and you can see the film. I got Dr. Spock. I got Leonard Nimoy to do the narration. I'd met him. He was interested in remote viewing. And anyway, they were able to locate a previously unknown wreck on the seafloor as determined by the Marine Sites Board. I guess I should say one thing to you, Gary. Unlike a lot of people that you're going to interview on this subject, I am a data person. I am not interested in philosophies, theories, speculations, schemes, whatever. All I care about is things that can be objectively verified. So when I tell you something, I'm perfectly happy to document it or to back it up with documentation or whatever. Anyway, so I got, this was the submarine that they gave me was from the University of Southern California, the Marine Sites Board, the Institute of Marine and Coastal Studies. And you can see there on the film their reaction to it. So they did find it. And even more interestingly, in many ways, the people that I put down in the submarine and took them down to depth were able to describe exactly where the people who were the outbound targets were and described what they were doing and you know, the colors, the shapes, the structures, all that. And so it answered the question, this is 1977, it answered the question finally, is this electromagnetic? And the answer is no, it is not. It is involving what I call non-local perception. And the other thing that it also suggests very strongly is that there is an aspect of consciousness which is outside of space-time. And I was very interested in that because in 1931, Max Planck, who was the father of quantum mechanics, was interviewed by the Observer newspaper in London. And Planck was not a guy who gave a lot of interviews, but the reporter went up to him and said, you know, you and Einstein are the most famous scientists in the world. I mean, you're historically famous. What have you learned? And I don't know what the reporter thought or his editor thought that they were going to get. But what Planck said, what I've learned is that consciousness is causal and fundamental. You cannot get behind consciousness. Space-time, materiality, arises from consciousness, not consciousness from space-time, because materialism believes that all consciousness is physiologically based, dead body, no consciousness. And so one of the other things that this submarine experiment is called the Deep Quest experiment, by the way. One of the other things that it showed was that there was this aspect of consciousness that was able to describe things that were completely unknown. Nobody had any idea that that wreck was there. And so it wasn't like you could have read up on it or read my mind or, you know, anything else. And the location, describing the where people were in their locations, meant that you could describe any distance. Distance didn't matter and time didn't matter. And that's a big deal to figure out, and that it wasn't electromagnetic. And that eventually led to a project called the Alexandria Project. But let me say, before we get into that, let me tell you a little bit about what remote viewing is, because there's an enormous amount of nonsense about this. First of all, although you would say historically, I am one of the people that created remote viewing. Remote viewing was really created by myself starting in 68, Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff starting about 72, Ed May, I've forgotten Ed, about 73, 74. The term remote viewing was coined by Ingo Swann, who was a remote viewer who started with SRI and then worked for my lab. My lab was called Mobius. There eventually, through the 70s to the 90s, there were three big labs that did most of the research. Mobius, my lab, and I focused principally on archaeological stuff, practical applications. SRI, which was up North California, and they did classified research for the CIA and military. I would not do classified research. I turned down $1,600,000 a year in 1984 or something. That was a lot of money because they wanted me to classify my research and I wouldn't do it. I felt that anything we knew about consciousness ought to be made available to everybody. And that's always been my position. So remote viewing. The oldest remote viewing we know about, because it was recorded by Herodotus in the it's about the 5th century B.C. In the 46th chapter of Herodotus' Histories of the World. Croesus, and we know his name because as rich as Croesus, and the reason we say as rich as Croesus is that Croesus was the first monarch to start coining money, making physical money out of gold and silver. And Croesus was told that the Phoenicians were going to invade him. Cyrus was going to invade him. And, of course, it frightened him because they were one of the biggest powers of the time. So he thought, well, what can I do? And his decision was there were then seven oracles in the Greek world. And these oracles essentially did remote viewing. And so he created seven teams of people, and he told them all that they were to go out and to these oracles, which are spread all over the Mediterranean area. And on the 100th day, they were to wait until the 100th day, and then they were to go in and they were to ask the oracle, the Pythonesses, at the Delphic oracle, as they were called, what is Croesus, son of Aliates, king of the Lydians, doing right now? Exactly the way we would do it today. It was an outbound experiment, just like the one I did at DeepQuest. So anyway, they sailed away to the various things, spread all over the Greek world. And when they got the oracle, the only one we know about is the Delphic oracle, because when the team went in to ask the oracle, before they even asked the question, she said, "I can count the sands of time, the 100 days, and I see the great ocean," that they'd come over the ocean. And they said, "Well, what is Croesus doing?" And they said, she said, "I see a great bronze urn and a bronze lid and a hare and a tortoise being cut up and thrown into this pot." And it made absolutely no sense to them. And they didn't believe it. They just didn't know what to make of it. So they went back. And when they got back to where Croesus was in Lydia, when he heard what they had to say, he bowed down and gave obeisance to the Delphic Oracle, because he had decided, very smart, on the 100th day, I'm going to do something that nobody would ever predict a king would be doing. You know, if you said he's sitting on his throne issuing edicts, well, that's what kings do. So he had a fire built in the courtyard of his palace, and he had a great bronze urn brought in and a tortoise and a hare, and he cut them up and threw them into the boiling water, and he put a bronze lid on it, exactly what the oracle had said. That is the oldest remote viewing we have on record. And basically what remote viewing is doing is the key to it, of all of it, whatever anybody else tells you, the key to it is that you have to be able to attain and sustain intentioned, focused awareness. That is, you have to quiet the mind. That's why meditators routinely do better than non-meditators. That's why they teach meditation in martial art dojos and Hindu temples and Buddhist monasteries and Tibetan monasteries, whatever, because they know that the ability to attain and sustain intention-focused awareness, however you do it, allows you to open to this other aspect of consciousness, the what I'll call the eternal self, what the religion calls the soul. And this is the part of consciousness that exists before you were born. It exists the whole time you are born. But mostly what it's telling you is not really taken regarded, except that we call it gut hunch or a woman's intuition, that kind of thing. Because we're normally, our minds are overpowered by the sense impressions that sweep in. It's cold, it's hot. I mean, you were talking earlier about the temperature. You know, it's cold, it's hot, it's light, it's dark, whatever. That's what constitutes most of our thinking, those kind of responses, sense impressions from our neuroanatomy. Remote viewing, non-local perception, is about quieting that, which is what you do when you meditate, and allowing yourself to open to this other part of your consciousness. And when you do that, you can obtain information about anything.
Now, here's why I want to jump in. The military did remote viewing for a period of time.
Yeah.
And what they would do is they would go basically in a room. They would be, you know, relaxed. They would have a pad of paper. They would have a pencil or a pen. And they would focus on a subject. In other words, like maybe a KGB agent in Russia. Or they would be focusing on something. Is that different than what you were doing?
No, not at all. I would, if you were a remote viewer for me, for instance, in the Alexandria Project, where we found Cleopatra's palace and Mark Antony's palace and the Lighthouse of Pharos, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, I would sit you down if you were doing, or you could be at your house, but I would, if we were doing it together, I'd sit you down and give you a map and a pad of paper and a pencil, and I would say to you, "Gary, would you please go over this map?" And my first question is Cleopatra's palace located within the confines of this map? And if you said yes, then I would say to you, "Well, could you draw me a little circle exactly where it is, as small as you could do it?" And you'd make your little circle, and I'd say, "Well, now if I go there, what am I going to find?" And they were doing, the SRI was doing the same thing. I mean, as I say, people have been doing this for a long time. We created it in the modern sense because the reason it got created was that at that time, that is the late 60s, early 70s, the biggest phenomena associated with parapsychological research was what was called the decline effect. They were getting people to guess, you know, dice or cards or things. And the more they did it, the worse they got, because it was boring. And so I and Russell and Hal decided that, well, let's come up with something, not together, but independently, let's come up with something that's interesting, that people, you know, they don't get bored with it, they get excited. And it was suggested by Ingo, and he was one of the first people to do it. A guy named Pat Price was another one of their viewers. And they found that they could accurately get information about locations. You know, the CIA would say, well, what do you get? It's latitude, longitude, whatever. And they would describe it. And I would say to people, what do you get if you go to this location? What am I going to find? And as I said, you can see the movie about the Deep Quest experiment. And you can also see the movie on the Alexandria Project. You can watch a man with an eighth grade education who was a parts manager at a Chrysler dealership in Nanaimo, Canada, up on Vancouver Island. You can watch him out of 1,700 square kilometers locate a buried building within a buried city, stake it out to within 28 inches of accuracy out of 1,700 square kilometers. And you can see a woman who was a fine arts photographer also locate it and describe exactly what would be there. They would, and everything that they said contradicted everything archaeology knew at the time, as you can see in the film. I mean, they didn't, they had had an electronic survey of the site and it and had reported that nothing was there. So they didn't believe anything was there in any case. And the description that Hella Hammett and George McMullen, the two remote viewers, described was that this was a Byzantine building, not a Roman building, and that it had a kind of column in the middle of it, and that it had a tile floor that was made of red, white, and black tiles that were about 5/16 of an inch. So out of 1,700 square kilometers, people accurately located objects 5/16 of an inch.
Wow, that is outstanding. I mean, I didn't know you could do that much. You know, when I had met Ed Dames on here, you know, he would talk about certain things, but you're explaining it a lot more deeper than he did, because, I mean, I didn't even know you could be that accurate.
Oh, absolutely. And let me just continue this thought for a moment. What this is also telling us, as I said, is that there is continuity of consciousness. You have to see the remote viewing work in the same context, for instance, as the near-death studies. You know, about 13 million people in the United States have had near-death experiences. And they all report, not all, everyone, but a large percentage of them report this experience of being outside of their bodies, and that they continue, their consciousness continues even though their body is dead. Or you look at the reincarnation research done by Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, or Erlander Harrelson at the University of Virginia or University of Iceland. And people describe, predict things that they could not know about previous lives that turn out to be correct. All of this stuff is telling us something about what reality is.
Now, I'm going to jump in here. You know, here's the thing. There was, you know, a report a while back, a couple of years ago, this young kid, he was like 5 years old, and he started talking to his parents, school, and all that stuff. He said, I was a fighter pilot during World War II. I flew a Spitfire. He told people about his, you know, what group he was in the UK, and all this stuff. And it was very, and names of people, very accurate. But then when he got older, it just like, It disappeared. Do younger kids, I'm talking under 7 years old, are they?
Yes, seven is the key age. The reincarnation stuff generally is young children, just as you describe. I know the case you're talking about, by the way. But when they become, their personalities become more developed, they just, it kind of falls into the background. It's not that they forget it, but it just isn't important compared to what's going on in their life now. And so a lot of these, a large percentage of these past life memory stories are young children, because, as I say, when they get older, typically about seven, they sort of fully incarnate in their modern life, and this other stuff just kind of falls away. No, I mean, I did a study with a young child who was born, and he had a scar on his back, like he'd been wounded. And I passed it on to some researchers, and they took him to, he had a very clear story that he was a moneylender and that he'd had an affair with a woman whose husband was a wood chopper. And that one day the husband came home as the woman and this guy were in bed together, and they heard him, and he was trying to climb out the window when he was struck with an axe and killed. And very detailed, and exactly where it was. The name of the village was a village nobody in his family had ever been to. So they took him to the village where he said it happened. And when he got to the border of the village, he immediately walked up to one particular house and knocked on the door. And this older woman came and opened the door, and he called her by a pet name, which surprised her, of course. And she said, how could you know that? And they described for her what it was, and she confirmed everything. She said, yes, when I was a younger woman, I had this affair and with this man who was a money lender, and he loaned my husband some money, and we were together, and my husband came home, and as he was trying to climb out the window, killed him with an axe.
Wow.
And while he was there, the boy said, well, I'd like to get my watch back. She said, well, I don't have your watch. And he said, oh, yes, you do. And he walked into the area where her, you know, in India, the a lot of the cooking is in these little courtyards. They do them outside. And he pulled a brick out from a place where the cooking was. And there, wrapped in a oilcloth, was this watch. And it was his watch. And she recognized it and said, oh, yes, that's your watch. Anyway, if you look at the work of Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, it took over from Ian, what you see is hundreds of cases where they get extraordinarily detailed information they couldn't possibly know. And in fact, they've done so well with this that they now are able to show that young people who were killed by violence in an unexpected accident of some kind, that the period of time between that death and the next incarnation is about 15 months. So we're beginning to understand this, but what I really want to stress is what it is telling us is that you are more than animated meat, that you are consciousness, and that what we call reality is in fact an information architecture created by intentioned consciousness. You know, when they asked Einstein, well, what do you mean? But what does reality mean? And he said, well, you have to think of it as an optical delusion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I want to jump in here because you were mentioning that. You know, there was a case, I don't know if it was India, I know it was Middle East, I think, where a boy was telling his parents that he was murdered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he kept telling his story. And finally, his parents couldn't take anymore. They take him to the local police. And he's telling them who killed him, where he lives. They go to the guy's house. They take the guy physically to where the boy says where his body is. They start, you know, digging there. They find the body right where he just says it is. And they convicted the guy for murder.
I can tell you another one of those. I did a film on reincarnation. And in one of the cases, a woman, a young woman, a girl, said that she had been given in an arranged marriage to a banker, to a wealthy man in India. I mean, I don't know how big a banker, but anyway, a banker, and that he didn't like her. And on the train, he killed her and threw her off the train. And she noticed as she went off the train where her body was, and they went back and found the body, just as you say, same thing. And they confronted him with it and her information, and he confessed. As far as I know, he's in jail now. But in any case, the point of all of this is that this information passes from life to life. That you're not coming back. Gary's not coming back. Stefan's not coming back. But that the eternal self, the what religion calls the soul, episodically manifests and incarnates another personality. And what comes across in that personality can be genetically manipulated, that is, genetically altered. People come back with scar tissue, like the story I told you about the boy in the watch, or they come back with birthmarks. So what comes across between lives is information. And of course, the question is, well, where is that information? And that leads us to the two great questions, which nobody can answer. I can't answer, and I don't know anybody that can. What is information and what is consciousness? What we can say is that consciousness appears to be a continuity. As I said, you existed prior to your birth, you exist during your physical life, and you continue afterwards, and then episodically that eternal self will manifest another personality, and certain information will come across.
Interesting. You know, our time is up, and I could talk to you for another a couple hours on the subject. You have a lot of books, and you have a website. Whatever you want to share, please do to the listeners.
Oh, okay. Well, my personal website is www.stephanashwartz.com. StephanaShwartz.com. And you can go there and you can see all of my books and you can get my papers and you can see these movies I was telling you about, the Alexandria Project and in Egypt and the Deep Quest Project. I publish a daily web publication, which is not about parapsychology. It's about social trends that are shaping the future. That's schwartzreport.net. You can go to academia.edu and you can get all of my papers. I publish everything in peer-reviewed academic journals. The books that, if you're interested in the remote viewing stuff, you want to look at are Opening to the Infinite, which will tell you everything science knows about remote viewing. No waffling, no false claims, none of the rest of it. This is everything science knows about it. Opening to the Infinite. If you want to get the book on the Alexandria Project, it's called The Alexandria Project. You can get my novels. I've written a series of novels, and one of them I think might be of interest to your folk. The first one is called Awakening, and it's everything I know about UFOs and aliens. And I put it as a novel because you can't document it in the same way that I document my remote viewing stuff. And the other two novels are The Vision, which is a novel about remote viewing and how it can be used and how it saves an explosion in Washington. And the other is called The Amish Girl, which is based on a true story that was covered by Nova. And it's about an Amish girl who was murdered and how they solved the crime using remote viewing. So all of my books are up there, my websites, my papers are all available. It's all freely available.
Well, Stefan, it's been really good having you on here. Again, give your website one more time out.
The personal one, StephanaSchwartz.com.
Everybody, please check it out. And Stefan, have a great weekend. It's coming up. We're going to have beautiful weather this weekend. Be prepared for it.
I'm looking forward to it, Gary. Thank you very much. You stay safe and well.
Okay, my friend, you take care and have a great weekend.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, you know what? Don't forget. James, who's Bob Clark's guest on Saturday?
Well, Bob Clark's guest is going to be Dean McMurray. He's known as the military medium, and he's going to talk about how his life changed when he, figured out he was a medium.
Okay, medium over or medium rare?
Medium all the time.
Okay. And again, starting next Friday, we're going to be going to 2 hours on Fridays. Now, I got to warn everybody, I'm going to be taking a week off in July. And do you have those dates at all? I'm going to be taking off.
I can punch them up here real quick. Let's see. Where are they now?
I'm going to have a vacation. I'm going to spend some time with the family. You know, spend some time with the horses and the goat that ran me a couple years ago. And do some painting on the deck and on the house. And maybe get rid of a couple trees. So I'm going to be really busy doing some of the stuff I haven't been doing for a long time. That's, well, taking care of the property. What dates have you found that?
Yeah, you're going to be taking off from July 10th until July 15th.
And we will be running replays, some of the best of the shows. And don't forget, starting this Friday, the last half an hour of that two-hour show, we would love you to call in if you had an experience with E.T., maybe been abducted, or you seen a UFO and it was kind of really strange. We want to know about it. In return, we're going to send you everything from a water bottle to all kinds of stuff. We got a whole bunch of stuff from what's going on this from the first to third at Roswell. And, I mean, we got water bottles, we got mugs, we got tumblers, we got stickers, we got pins, all kinds of cool stuff. And, you know, for your story, we'll send you out one of those cool things. We even have a couple tank top tees, Roslyn, with the ET on it. That is starting next Friday. Well, everybody, make sure you give me a thumbs up on the show. That's very important. Tell your friends about us. You can check out our website. You can see all the stuff on our website that we're going to be giving out. Just go to it. I revamped the website a little bit. And you'll see who our guest is all the way next week. So, you know, be prepared for some shock because we got some really great guests. Now, we're going to change the guest we had for Friday, and we're going to have who on next Friday?
Well, next Friday, we're going to have Kevin Randall on, who is a UFO Roswell expert. He's written many books. Matter of fact, he's got a new book out, so he's going to be on talking about everything Roswell.
And why not? Because the festival starts from the 1st to 3rd at Roswell. And let me know if you're going to that festival by contacting me on our website. There's like a little notepad. Just click on that, and that sends an email directly to me again. Or you can actually go to my email, nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com. Everybody have a good one. We will catch you on the other side next Tuesday, so stay tuned.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.